We are honored this morning in having as our speaker the president of the General Board of the Relief Society of our church. Sister Spafford was at one time a teacher in our BYU training school, and we are proud of the record which she has made since that time. She was appointed to the General Board of the Relief Society in 1935, served as a counselor for some time to Sister Amy Brown Lyman, and in 1945 was sustained as general president. She has also served as editor of the Relief Society magazine and at the present time is its general manager. She's also editor of the book entitled A Centenary of Relief Society. We are proud of the fact that she has been third vice president, second vice president, and first vice president of the National Council of Women. And if I recall correctly, this last year was head of the United States Delegation of Women meeting in an international conference in Finland. At the present time, she's vice chairman of the Crusade for Freedom campaign in Utah. We've had the honor of awarding her the Distinguished Service Award, BYU Alumni Association. We are favored by her presence this morning, and it's my privilege to introduce her to you, Sister Belle Spafford.
It is always an honor to me to be invited to participate in the activities of Brigham Young University. As Dr. Wilkinson has told you, I was at one time a student here and also a teacher in the training school. However, the campus has greatly changed since the day when I was here. I do feel the same fine spirit in the school, and I'm sure that the educational goals of this great institution have not changed through the years. For this is a church institution, and the educational goals of the church do not change. I have been asked to speak to you today on the work of international women, as reflected in the conference of the International Council of Women, held during the past summer in Helsinki, Finland. International relations are enlisting a great deal of the time, attention, and funds of the American people. I am amazed at the number of groups, even very small groups, which have an international relations committee as one of their standing committees. When one considers that on my return from Europe to the United States, I left Paris at noon on a Tuesday, flew to London where I spent 5 hours, then on to Iceland where I spent 3 hours, and arrived in Boston at 6:30 Wednesday morning. He realizes that in point of time at least, the people across the seas are very close neighbors. Our concern is thus heightened that international relations shall be established on a peaceful basis. It was a privilege and a very enlightening experience to attend the great conference of more than 500 women gathered from 34 free nations of the world. I think I shall never forget nor cease to talk about the deep feelings that stirred within me at the official opening of the conference, when, as chairman of the National Council of Women of the United States, it was my privilege to lead the chairman of the respective delegations to the dais of the festival hall in the new and modern University of Finland building and be formally introduced as I stood in front of my nation's flag. Beautiful young Finnish girls dressed in native costume had preceded the delegates to the platform, and each carried a flag of one of the representative nations. And as the representatives were introduced, they stood in front of their flags. I realized as I stood in front of the glorious stars and stripes that night that ours is a land choice above all other lands. I realized that our flag is the symbol of a land that opens its doors to people of all nations, freedom-loving peoples. Ours is a land where men and women place a spiritual interpretation on the universe, a land dedicated to the promotion of peace, justice, and human well-being. I was deeply grateful that night that I was an American, as I am today. Just as my appreciation of the greatness of my country was enlarged through my experiences abroad, so my comprehension was increased of the greatness of my church and the need for the restored gospel in the lives of people throughout the world as the one sure road to international understanding and peace. Throughout my travels abroad, I was always grateful that I was a Latter-day Saint. I was brought to realize that the light for which organized women are reaching in many of their problems has been ours for more than a century. Substantiating this opinion is a letter I received from a woman recently following a talk I gave on the message of the conference. She wrote, "Dear Sister Spafford, you didn't bring us anything new. Did women have to go clear to Finland to learn what we have known for years?" Let me give you a more specific example. In one of the discussions on the increasing use of narcotics among teenagers, a judge of a probate court, a member of the World Order of Women Magistrates, said she had never dealt with a teenage addict who had not first been a tobacco user. She wondered if the non-use of tobacco was not the beginning point in dealing with the evil of heroin and marijuana smoking. The great disciplines of the gospel of Jesus Christ give to us as individuals and as a people unbounded strength. The road by which I received the appointment to the Helsinki Conference has been a long one and at times a rugged one for Mormon women. In 1880, a conference called by the National Woman's Suffrage Association convened in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the first public demand ever made for equal educational, industrial, and professional rights for women. Both national and international women were invited to attend, among them Mormon women. The women of Utah had been granted the vote in 1870. In fact, Seraph Young, a grandniece of Brigham Young, had been the first woman in the United States to cast her ballot. In fairness, however, we must say that the Wyoming women were given the voting privilege before the Utah women, but the Utah election came first, thus making it possible for Seraph Young to hold this distinction. Mormon women had enjoyed the religious vote from the very founding of the church. They had deep-seated feelings with regard to national suffrage. They attended the Washington Conference with the advice of the presiding authorities of the church. So important was the occasion regarded by the First Presidency that according to the diary of Emmeline B. Wells, the women were set apart for this work as a mission. The chief outcome of this Washington Conference was the formation of the National Council of Women of the United States to be made up of national associations within the country, and the projection of a permanent international council to which none but national councils would be eligible as auxiliaries. Relief Society and the Young Women's Organization became charter members of these councils. Through the years, both councils have worked zealously in the interest of suffrage. As you know, United States women won suffrage in 1920 with the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. However, there are still many countries in the world where women do not enjoy suffrage. For example, Switzerland. Suffrage is by no means the only interest of the councils today. Other worthy causes enlist their support. During its lifetime, the National Council of United States has had its good days and its bad, its days of strength and its days of weakness, depending on circumstances. Mormon women have had their periods of recognition and their periods when they have not been so favorably considered. When I was named president of Relief Society, one of the first invitations to reach my desk was one to attend a biennial meeting of the National Council of Women. This was at a time following the war when the council was at a low ebb and when, at least in my opinion, I felt that Mormon women were not being properly considered. Gathering up a number of arguments as ammunition, I went to President George Albert Smith with the recommendation that Relief Society withdraw from the council. I concluded my arguments in favor of my position by saying, Relief Society is really getting nothing from the council. In his characteristic manner, President Smith leaned back in his chair and smiled. Then he said, Sister Spafford, you surprise me a little. Do you always think in terms of what you get? Don't you ever think in terms of what you have to give? Mormon women have something to give to the women of the world. You had better retain your membership and accept this invitation. Take Sister Priscilla Evans, a member of your board and an attorney, and other board members, and give something to the women of your nation and to the women of the world. At this point, I am reminded of the words of President J. Reuben Clark, Jr., spoken to Relief Society at a General Relief Society conference not so long ago. President Clark said, "This is your destiny and ours, to save the world." Needless to say, we attended the New York conference with pronounced feelings of obligation and with a full determination to make a contribution to the work of the council. This has been our determination since that time. Just as President Smith encouraged our participation in the affairs of these organizations, so President McKay has encouraged us to remain active. His personal interest in my attendance at the Helsinki conference, together with his frequent and wise counsel, were a source of great strength to me in meeting the obligations of my assignment as chairman of the United States group. Finland, the site of the conference, far to the north with its limitless forests, its beautiful blue inland lakes, its long summer nights, and its warm, hospitable people, is an interesting land. It is a land whose people have suffered much. It has known two Soviet invasions in this generation, and before that, 700 years of enmity and antagonism, with 70 years of actual war. Helsinki, Finland's beautiful capital city, with a population of approximately 400,000, has preserved much of its old character, yet retains much that is new and modern. This city was a unique and an attractive setting for the conference. My duties as chairman of the United States delegation may be of interest to you. They were to convey to our delegates instructions from the United States Executive Committee, to make assignments, particularly with regard to the sections of the conference each delegate should attend, to hold meetings with the delegation during the conference, to determine the position the delegation should take on resolutions and other matters coming before the conference on which we had not been instructed, to poll the delegates on matters to be voted upon, and cast the votes for the council. All voting was by unit rule. to attend all executive sessions and speak for the United States Council, to speak for the United States Council on all matters coming before general sessions, to accept or reject social invitations, and arrange for attendance of the delegates at social functions, to make any necessary contacts with the American legation. I cite these duties in order that you may know the nature of my assignment, and because it is my conviction that similarly important assignments will come to Mormon women in the future with increasing frequency. They may come to some of the women assembled here today. Upon our arrival in Finland, almost the first telephone call we received was from the American minister, Mr. Jack McFall, inviting us to the American legation for a briefing on the history and the political situation in Finland. Although we were not officially sent by our State Department, it was regarded as imperative that we have this opportunity, since whatever we did or said reflected upon our nation and was regarded as the viewpoint and opinion of organized women of the nation. At this point, I think it may be of interest to you to know that when the United States delegation was received at the legation, a maid came into the room with a large silver tray. On the tray were glasses of white wine and red wine and two glasses of tomato juice. One glass of tomato juice was handed to me, the other to Sister Marva Josephson, who was representing the Young Women's Organization. How they knew our standards, I do not know. But this I do know. It was not expected there or at any other place that I attended that we would violate the standards of our church. The International Council of Women brings together triennially women of many races, nations, creeds, and classes in the belief that the good of humanity and the well-being of the home and family will be advanced by greater unity of thought, purpose, and action on the part of organized women. It subscribes to the belief that such an organized movement, which serves to promote the highest good of the family, will in turn promote the highest good of the state. The delegates to the conference were an interesting group. They were distinguished and scholarly women, leading women in their respective countries. The Helsinki newspaper referred to them as, and this is a quote, influential, enlightened, gifted, responsible women. The nations represented varied widely in their culture, traditions, social and economic and political lives, and in their interests and problems. For example, the Status of Women resolution submitted by Iran and Haiti called for such things as freedom in the choice of a spouse, suppression of bride price, the right of a widow to the custody of her children, and so on. At the same time, the vital interest of United States women was in the Pacific uses of nuclear fission. However, I soon learned that widely diversified as are the nations, there are many basic things on which world women can and do come together. The theme of the conference was women's responsibility to the opportunities and dangers of the atomic age. In referring to the theme, Dr. Jean Ader, the international president, said, "Today's generations are fated to stand on the frontiers of this new development, gazing with awe into a future destined to be very different from the past, in which the atom will bring enormous new good or evil, unpredictable today and depending on the use humanity will make of its powers." She pointed out that woman must continue to carry her world-old duties of mother, householder, educator, and the living conscience of her contemporaries. But she asked if she would also accept new interests and duties in communities, working world, native land, and international relations. She referred to the present as needing our work, our meditation, and our choice of values. The fore part of the conference was devoted to sectional meetings, where matters and resolutions related to the respective sessions were considered. In order that you may have some idea of the scope of interests of this great federation of women, the following sections were held: arts, letters and music, child welfare, cinema, education, finance, health, home economics, housing, laws, suffrage, migration, moral welfare, peace and international relations, press and public relations, radio, television, trades and professions. I was assigned to the section on moral welfare. I wish I had time to tell you some of the reports that were made there. The latter part of the conference was devoted to executive and general sessions, and resolutions and matters requiring vote were acted upon in the general sessions. A total of 24 resolutions was adopted. Time will permit but brief reference to these resolutions. The two submitted by the National Council of United States were adopted. The first had to do with the Technical Assistance Program and urged that the provisions of technical assistance should be accompanied by a better understanding of the traditions, the customs, and the psychological requirements of the beneficiary countries. It stressed the insufficiency of bringing only material and cultural benefits to receiving countries without taking into account the specific spiritual needs. The second resolution submitted by the Council had to do with child welfare and urged the development of programs of long-range benefit to children rather than confinement to programs for emergent relief. Drawing forth the greatest interest was the resolution having to do with atomic energy. Aware that enormous potentialities are now available to mankind for good or evil in the energy released by nuclear fission, the International Council aims to unite women the world over to work against the destructive and aggressive uses of these energies, to work for their international control and for their Pacific uses. The Council acknowledged its respect for the home and the close relationship of good homes to a contented, peace-loving citizenry. It was the opinion that there is need for a higher conception of life in a greater number of homes throughout the world, a conception favored by a greater concern for spiritual values. The high divorce rate in all of the nations was deplored. The competition between home and a profession was regarded as one of the most burning problems of women today. The Council supports the contention that moral well-being is basic to a strong, enduring, and expanding world civilization, and that it is accorded all too small a part in the organized and coordinated efforts of countries and their people. You may be sure that peace and international relations were of primary concern. The Council takes this stand with regard to the United Nations. It declares the United Nations to be the best presently available instrument for the accomplishment of international understanding and well-being. Three new councils were admitted to membership: Nigeria, Pakistan, and Israel. Considerable fanfare attends the admission of a council. The credentials of an applying council are carefully reviewed by the ICW board, and then, while the chairman awaits decision outside the conference hall, the executive committee, composed of the chairman of the respective nations, review the credentials. If the council is accepted, the doors of the conference hall are swung open and the chairman is admitted. It was a bit startling to most of us when the doors opened for the Nigerian woman. She was a large native woman dressed in colorful robe and turban, a chieftain in her country. Her acceptance speech was so impressive, one lost sight of everything but the seriousness of her purpose. She addressed the group by saying, "My most distinguished and scholarly women of all the world, I salute you. Then she told of the prevalence of illiteracy in her country. She said a fund had been set up by the government for the removal of illiteracy, but it was available to the male sex only. She felt if she could enlist the support and learn procedures from the council, she might lead the organized women of her nation in winning suffrage. She said if they had suffrage, they could influence legislation, and they would see to it that such a fund was made available to women also. She said if we educate our women, we will educate our children, and our nation will overcome illiteracy. Prior to leaving the conference, because she knew of my great personal interest in suffrage, she gave me her card, on the bottom of which were engraved these words, "Trust in God and do the right." The entire conference had an excellent official recognition. The American minister to Finland, in addition to inviting the United States delegation to the legation for briefing, also honored us by being in attendance with Mrs. McFaul at the official opening of the conference. Mrs. McFaul gave a delightful luncheon for the delegation at the legation, to which, I might say, Sister Mae Mattis, the Relief Society president of the Finnish mission, was also invited and seated with me at the head table. I assure you that things are correctly done in the American embassy. The Finnish Council arranged many delightful social functions for the delegates. Foremost of these was a reception given at the Finnish Palace by Madam Alla Paasikiva, the wife of the President of Finland and the patron of the conference. Undoubtedly, the conference accomplished much good by way of promoting greater understanding and appreciation of the problems of the different nations and by the friendships established. Good is bound to grow out of such a conference because the attention of organized women was brought into focus on problems that should be of concern to women. I was deeply impressed with the sweep of the conference, the willingness of the women of all nations to work together for common goals, and with the power inherent in the conference through its connection with so many important organizations of women. Following the conference, I visited a number of European countries. I was impressed with the growing strength of the church and with the great importance of Latter-day Saints living up to what they profess as Latter-day Saints. Let me tell you a story that I think may be of interest to you as Brigham Young University students. In one of the European mission homes, I met a young missionary who was counselor to the president of the mission. He had been a convert to the church only a little more than 1 year when he received his mission call. I asked him how he happened to join the church. He said he had attended one of the large Eastern universities where he was earning his tuition by selling beer in a tavern. He often watched the boys who came into the place to buy beer. A growing disgust developed within him as he watched so many of the fine, trained young men waste themselves and their time on drinking. Later, he moved to California and enrolled in one of the universities there. One day, a young man came into the inn where he was working and invited him to join him in drinking a glass of beer. He said the boy didn't look mill run, so he accepted the invitation. He asked the young man what he was doing there. The boy explained that he had come from Utah, that he had been attending Brigham Young University, but he had left the school because of its strict disciplines. He told of the ban of the school against smoking and drinking among the students, saying the restrictions were so irksome to him that he had been forced to leave. The young missionary said he thought to himself, "What a wonderful school, and how very right they are." He was so interested in a university which had such standards that he cultivated the companionship of this young man, often going to his room where they played cards. One day there came to the room, and I know my time is up, a second Latter-day Saint student to visit his friend. This boy sat and watched the card game, but did not play. He casually explained that it was against his teachings as a Latter-day Saint. The young missionary said he immediately became interested in this boy who lived as he was taught and as he believed. He was intrigued by a church which had such unusual, yet to him sound teachings. He determined to learn something of this second boy. He cultivated his friendship, which resulted in his conversion to the church. Now, I have lived to see how true were the words of President Smith when he said, "Mormon women have something to give to the women of the world." This mandate given to me to go forth and give something to the women of the nation and to the women of the world, together with the counsel of President McKay, were constantly before me in the discharge of my duties as chairman of the National Council. With a consequent influence with which I was blessed in decisions and actions. Latter-day Saints have a priceless contribution to make to the world. We make our contributions in the daily conduct of our lives, in the influence we exert upon individuals and groups with whom we associate, in the direction we give to the thinking, the attitudes, and the viewpoints of our associates. We must not think in terms of what we can get from the world, but in terms of what we as Latter-day Saints have and must give to the world. It is vitally important that young men and women of the church, you of Brigham Young University, be led by this philosophy. For I assure you, the only sure road to individual and world understanding and peace is to follow the paths of peace marked out by the Master and enunciated in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. And may the Lord bless us to this end, I pray, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.